Hey, insiders. We're taking the Stay Tuned podcast on the road this fall, and I'm excited to announce a new stop. On November 5th, we'll be in Minneapolis in the great state of Minnesota. Joining me is former marathoner, city councilman, civil rights attorney, son of professional ballet dancers, and now still in his 30s, mayor of the city, Jacob Frey. You're not going to want to miss this rising star. In addition to Minneapolis, I'll be in Atlanta with Sally Yates, in Denver with Shannon Watts, and in Detroit with Attorney General Dana Nessel. To get tickets and details of all these upcoming live shows, head to cafe.com/tour. That's cafe.com/tour. From Cafe, welcome to Cafe Insider. I'm Preet Bharara.
And I'm Ann Milgram.
Ann, it's good to have you back in the studio.
Yeah, it's good to be back in person.
Back to school.
Oof.
Sad. Sad.
Yeah.
And a little bit harder to get into the groove of things. Lots of things going on, millions of things we need to talk about. One thing that is continuing to transpire as we sit is Hurricane Dorian, which is basically moving very slowly.
Yeah.
Off the coast. Unclear what is going to happen there. There's still a lot of danger, but it seems like some parts of the U.S. will be spared. Can I tell you my one observation about it?
Yes.
Did you see photographs and video and interview of the guys who follow the hurricane in the military airplane?
I didn't see that.
And they're incredibly brave and great. And they literally fly through the hurricane and 180 mile per hour winds. Hurricane hunters, I think they're called. And they fly into the eye and take these beautiful pictures and then do measurements so that they can more accurately predict where the hurricane is going to go. And I thought to myself, why can't those guys be the pilots on all my flights? Do you
want to fly into
a
hurricane?
Can you imagine? Well, I imagine there's some turbulence that they have to handle.
Right.
And I don't know.
You just think they're great pilots.
And I'm thinking, dude who can handle Hurricane Dorian,
yeah,
can like land at LaGuardia pretty easily.
Definitely.
Right?
I'll tell you, I saw the video of Chef Jose Andres, who's down in the Bahamas to coordinate the relief efforts, both shelter and food. And he's, I don't know, 90 or 100 miles away. And the storm, it looks like the most intense storm you can possibly imagine. He's not even in the eye of the hurricane.
Well, he's a great man doing a lot of great
Absolutely.
Stuff. Great stuff.
And all good thoughts go out to everybody who's along the path of the hurricane.
I don't know how many times we have begun a show. It's becoming a routine now, mentioning a tragic mass shooting over the weekend. There was another one this past weekend.
I mean, I feel like if we looked at our shows, the number we started, it's, I don't know what the number is, but even one is too many. And I think, you know, we're starting to have a conversation in the country. I think the conversation is starting to change. I don't know if you feel this or if I'm in a bubble on it, but I feel like the conversation is starting to change and it's becoming more of why are we letting a small minority of people in our country essentially allow a lack of gun restrictions and allow people to kill our kids? And I do think that the sort of public line and sentiment on this is moving. Frankly, I don't think it's moving quickly enough, but I think that there's a conversation that's changing.
Well, I hope so.
And I would point out one thing. I mean, Asha Rangappa, who does CNN with us, she's a teacher at Yale. She did a pretty good thread yesterday on Twitter, and she basically goes through the need for universal background checks, but she also talks about, and I think this is really important for people to understand how complicated it is that a lot of people don't currently buy guns through federally licensed firearms dealers. A lot of people buy guns gun to gun, person to person. That the states have different rules in this space. Some of them require vetting, a very small number require vetting before a firearm is sold from person to person. Some don't do a good job of reporting to the federal government when people have things like mental illness or other things that would actually disqualify them from buying a firearm. And so one of the things that Asha started to think about, and I think this is a really important piece of the conversation, so I just throw this out there, is you remember the Highway Traffic Safety Act, where basically there were the drinking age was 18, and there was a whole conversation about there's research that shows we save lives if we move the drinking age to 21.
Right. And then everyone did.
And the states didn't want to do it because Right. It's state run, just like a lot of the firearms restrictions are. But what the federal government basically said is, fine, you lose money for your federal highways unless you do it. And so all of a sudden, all the states did it. And universally, we've had a drinking age of 21. So I think to her point, and I think it's an important point, is that it's a very complex system as it currently exists. It's like Swiss cheese, but it's not without precedent that there are ways to make it a lot better and a lot more coherent. And it's really, to me right now, it's just a question of political will.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely correct. So at long last, a big Inspector General report released last week on the conduct of the former FBI director, James B. Comey. And we have a lot to talk about with respect to that, because like every other document that comes out, whether it's an IG report or a newspaper article or the Mueller report, people tend to use it for their own purposes, you know, don't necessarily focus rigorously on what it means and what it says and what it doesn't say. So a few top line things to mention right off the bat, and then we'll go into some details, is one, the Inspector General, Michael Horowitz, did not find that Jim Comey passed any classified information to the press. None. As far as I can tell, nothing in the memos that Jim Comey wrote. And obviously this report was about seven quote-unquote memos, and some of them were not even memos, they were just emails, that Jim Comey wrote contemporaneously with meeting with the President of the United States, because he thought the President of the United States was acting inappropriately, to put it mildly. And with respect to his treatment of those memos, there was an investigation that was done. So point number one, the Inspector General's exhaustive report found that Jim Comey did not pass along classified information to the press, none, which as far as I can tell, nothing in the memos is in dispute by any reasonable person. There was no finding that Jim Comey was dishonest or misled, and we'll get to later this issue about whether or not Andy McCabe, the former deputy director of the FBI, whether or not he will be charged with making a false statement. No suggestion here that a false statement was made or that lies were told. No suggestion anywhere that it was wrong to write these memos, to take contemporaneous notes of interactions with the president. There's other things that are in dispute, but those bottom line things I think are important to state at the outset.
Yeah, it's important to state that. It's also important to just note that the intentional leaking of classified information, which this isn't, is actually a crime. And so this is, it's really important that the Inspector General, and the Inspector General report was sent to the Department of Justice, which declined any prosecution, finding that there was absolutely no intent whatsoever that Comey intended to share classified materials with anyone, because there is, and we should talk about sort of how this unfolded, because it's quite unusual. It's quite an unusual set of circumstances. But it's really important to note that there's just no evidence of any potential intent to leak classified information.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that's clear, if you haven't had time to read the IG report, and you can disagree with Jim Comey, and by the way, should also state at the outset, the Inspector General used fairly strong language to criticize Jim Comey's handling of this information, even though said there was no intent to distribute classified information, was very strong about how inappropriate it was to violate certain policies and procedures. But there's seven memos that he wrote. He didn't disclose them all. He took great care on his own as someone who, as the FBI director, had original classification authority to redact portions of the things that he thought might be classified. So he himself evinced an interest, a good faith interest, in making sure that things that could conceivably be, in his mind, classified were redacted from the document or not disclosed at all. And as you pointed out, the thing that's in question, and people go back and forth, and I think they're not, you know, fully honest about it when they're attacking Jim Comey on television, and there's plenty of things to criticize him for, when they say there was classified information in one of the memos. At the time that Jim Comey created the document, there was one memo in which he recounts a conversation with the president, and where the president, you know, incidental to the conversation they were having, talks about the importance of calling back leaders of countries quickly. And there was a mention of several countries. And I think after Jim Comey left, he made the original determination that was not classified, as is his right. And then after Jim Comey was fired, and they went back and looked, the FBI, which is its right, made a determination that some of those words, and ultimately it was only one word,
one name of one country. Yeah.
Was classified. And so to make the argument, like some people have gone on television to do, and the president has done, to say that this is the leaking of classified information. At the same time, by the way, that it appears the president himself tweeted out a picture of a launch site from Iran.
Yes, we should talk about that
every
separately.
Expert says,
yes, must be classified.
Must be classified. And does, you know, immense damage. This idea that he intentionally leaked classified information is just wrong in every respect.
Yes. Well, to go back just for 1 minute to the conversation you're referencing between Trump and Comey, it actually related to Flynn, and Flynn taking too long to call back a world leader. And so Trump then starts talking about, well, you know, he gives examples of these three countries, two of which apparently I think he thinks you should call back quickly, and one of which it appears that he thinks, like, who cares? You don't have to call them back.
Right. My guess is the call back quickly, Russia.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the who cares, it could be, I don't know, it could be the UK. It could also be the Netherlands.
There are exactly.
Unless Greenland is involved.
Yes. Norway. I mean, Sweden. There's so many that are potentially on that list. But basically, it was actually a sensitivity to the State Department that we don't want the United States having information out where the president is, you know, saying something ill about another country. It doesn't help our diplomatic efforts. And so it was classified at a low level. So it's important just to understand that. But to go back a step and just sort of play it out, to your point, Comey is in the middle of these interactions with the president. And by the way, I'm going to be extremely critical in a minute of him when we come to the leak conversation and the fact that he leaked information to the press, because I think that I have to put that in a separate bucket from the rest of the conversation. So Comey has these conversations and meetings with the president. And we have to remember, and I think one of the faults I would give to the IG report a little bit is that this is an extraordinary time and there is no playbook for this. Comey has these conversations. He does these seven memos. He himself makes a determination that memos 1 and 3 are classified because, as you said, he's the director of the FBI. He is classification authority. He's able to say, I think they're classified things. He gives copies of all 7 memos to his chief of staff. Then he takes...
To be retained in the FBI.
Right. And I would argue, and this is something you and I should talk about in a second, but I would argue that might have not been the right call to just give them to the chief of staff. And so let's talk about that in 1 minute. But what happens is that when he leaves the FBI, he does not take memos 1 and 3, which he believes are classified because he has classified them. And that's a really important fact. So he basically is taking what he believes is unclassified material, 2, 4, 6, and 7, those memos he takes home. He then shares some of those memos with his lawyers. He's got 3 lawyers who are like the sort of dream team.
It's like people I know well.
Exactly.
You know, former SEC, David Kelly, Patrick Fitzgerald, among others.
Yep. And Dan Richmond, who teaches at Columbia, who's the one
we're going to get to
leaked.
Him in a moment.
Yes, exactly. So he shares with his lawyers and then directs Dan Richmond, his lawyer, who's a professor at Columbia, to share the contents, not the actual memo 4, but the contents of what's included in memo 4 with a media outlet.
I think a particular New York Times reporter.
Yes. And that's what gets to this sort of conversation about the leaks. So, but it is important to your point that at the time Comey took the memos and shared the memos initially, there was no classification. The FBI then goes back and does what they often do, and they classify it. They then alert him that it's been classified. But at the time of these actions, it's important to know that it's very clear that Comey didn't believe any of it was classified. And again, one word ends up being classified, which is not, and that was never shared with the media.
Later.
Exactly, right. Later. Can we go back to this question of what Comey should have done up front with the memos? Because nobody really talks about this, but I think...
Well, some people have said that, you know, there's a process by which you put memos... and reports of interviews into the system. It's called a 302. I've read thousands of them in my day. And any FBI agent has written thousands or tens of thousands of them. This was a peculiar circumstance, by the way.
Yeah.
And Jim Comey is not a line special agent who's interviewing a witness.
Nor do you want him to be a witness in the case as the director of the FBI.
It's an extraordinary thing for which there is not really a playbook, right? In the same way that I had interactions with the sitting president, my interactions were when he was president-elect, and then he tried to have an interaction with me when he was the sitting president, and I refused the call. But there's not a playbook for that. It's an odd and weird thing. And
you essentially had your chief of staff in the room when you called back.
Yeah,
or
you want to contest
your senior.
You know, what's lost in all of this, and we'll get to the critical part in a moment, is what is the thing about which Jim Comey was preparing memos? It wasn't about sources and methods. It wasn't about... assets, intelligence assets somewhere else. It wasn't something that was going to compromise some inquiry into foreign intelligence. It was about the leader of the country engaging in what he thought was either was or was bordering on obstruction. And going back to what I said at the beginning, you need to write that down. You know, there have been these other reports that in different contexts, Rod Rosenstein, I still believe this to be true, although he denies it, thought about in the aftermath of Jim Comey being fired, Rod Rosenstein, jokingly or not, and I believe not jokingly, suggested wearing a wire and going to talk to the president. And all these things that happened, you can't divorce them from the time. In the week or 2 weeks after Jim Comey was fired, lots of regular, sane people, including leaders in the Congress and others, and myself included as a private citizen, thought that democracy was really at risk, that you had an out-of-control, unhinged president who was prepared to do any and all things. And so you can fault Comey for the way he did it, but I do not actually fault him for having a concern about, you know, a renegade president who was violating all these principles of the rule of law and looked like he was not just in the past obstructing justice, but could, as Jim Comey was sitting there, having just been fired, be obstructing right and left. You know, lots of people thought, and in the report that Mueller wrote, there's a very, very heavy conclusion in my mind that the firing of Jim Comey itself was part of obstructive conduct. So that can't be lost in all of this.
Right. I agree very strongly with that. And on memorializing all the conversations, because it's really important. And this is what FBI agents do, is that they memorialize information as it happens or as it's ongoing. And then it's a recollection of essentially the event as quickly and close in time as possible. And that's when your memory is the best. And so it's really important that he did it. I think in my mind, one of the questions I'm sort of thinking through, and I don't suggest I have the right answer here, but it's these memos that he did were both about somebody who is the president of the United States who happens to be, there's an investigation going on at that moment in time. And he is the subject, at least, of an investigation.
Not, he the president.
And so it's not, you know, you're having a conversation with somebody who's not a target or a potential subject of an investigation. You're actually having misconduct, and the potential obstruction goes to the existence of this ongoing investigation. So it is part and parcel of an ongoing criminal matter. It's also separately for Comey, he's the leader of the FBI. He's being put in a terrible position, and he's got to write it down, his version of events, memorialize it. It's almost like his insurance policy, which is like, hey, this happened, and I'm going to make sure that there's a contemporaneous document that shows, and that I had this conversation with my chief of staff right away. These are the kind of things you and I would use to judge witness credibility all the time in cases, is like, you know, did you tell someone else? Did you write it down? It really bolsters the case. So he's got these two separate things going on, and he gives a copy to his chief of staff. He says he doesn't give a copy to the investigators because he doesn't want to taint them, right? And it makes sense
it's
on
odd.
Some level, right? It's really odd. He's the head of the FBI. He doesn't want to taint them. But at the same time, they're investigating all the Russia connections. And in my view, they actually should have known.
Right.
But I don't necessarily think he should have done a 302 either. So I struggle a little with, like, what should the playbook be?
It's a very smart point that you made, which is, in his mind, I don't know if it's so much that he was worried that it would taint them. That's part of it. But also in part, it seems to me from recollecting what he said about it, that he was worried in part that it would have some prohibitive effect. I mean, essentially, for investigators to know that the president wanted a particular result or wanted people not to be looking at things might affect their conduct. And he didn't want them to be aware that the president had this.
In some ways, he's trying to buffer them, right? He's trying to protect them in some ways, yeah.
But it's like the same problem in 2016. And look, there's a lot of people who have faulted Jim Comey, and I should say it again for people who don't know. I admire him, like him, think he's an honest person. Used to work for him when he was a U.S. attorney, and I was a line assistant. But yes, I think he made mistakes. But you're presented with these crazy situations, like a president kicking out the attorney general, Jeff Sessions, from the room.
Right.
And then when you're alone with the FBI director, you basically say, hey, can you lay off Michael Flynn, who's my political ally?
Yeah.
And my former national security advisor. It's crazy stuff. And so all of this has to be looked at in that context. Now, if we can now talk about what the IG report says that's negative, it was a weird way of going about this. I'll never forget being in the actual Senate hearing room in the summer of 2017 when Jim Comey finally gets to come and testify. And there's an exchange he has with a member of the Senate panel where he's asked about this New York Times article. And Comey, once again, whatever you might say, you know, he clearly answered the question and said, I don't have the testimony in front of me and didn't review it for this. But I'm sitting there and he says, you could hear a pin drop, that he provided information to a friend of his who's a lawyer with the instruction to provide it to a member of the press, which was kind of jaw-dropping right there.
Yep.
And the funny thing about that, some people thought they knew who it was. and they were wrong. And he says, without naming him, he says, it's a professor at Columbia Law School. And I knew immediately it must be Dan Richmond, who I know, and is a nice guy, an honorable guy, and a smart guy. Former Southern District, as they all seem to be.
Yeah.
And a longtime friend of Jim Comey's. And I'm looking at my Twitter feed while the hearing is going on in that remarkable situation. The funniest tweet that I've read, like 10 or 20 minutes after Jim Comey makes this reference to his friend who leaked information to the press, was the Columbia Law School, my alma mater, the Columbia Law School Twitter account sent out a tweet saying, our server is down. there were so many people going apparently on the faculty website to figure out who the hell the person was that it actually overloaded the Columbia Law School server. The thing about it that's odd to me, and that I think some people can find at least some fault with, and there's a question about whether or not it was whistleblowing, he wasn't so forthright about it, right? So he was out of office. I think his intentions were good. He, in good faith, wanted to make sure that the right thing was done. He, in his own words, in his own testimony, said, I was looking for there to be the prompting of the appointment of a special counsel. But he doesn't go out and say all this stuff. He didn't wait till the hearing and say, ladies and gentlemen of the Senate, I believe that the President of the United States tried to obstruct doing these things. And if you thought it was appropriate to get out, then you might as well attach your name to it.
Right.
And doing the bank shot of wanting the information to come out, but at the same time, not wanting to be known as the source of the information, that's the thing that makes a lot of people in the Inspector General's office, I think, appropriately queasy, and maybe some members of the public.
It makes me queasy, right? There's something missing from the IG report, which is the context of the situation and how complex and difficult. You know, you and I can sit here and say, should Comey have shared the memos with someone other than his chief of staff? And we don't even have an agreement. I mean, this is a very complex moment in time, and there's a lot of equities to be weighed and things to consider. So I think not acknowledging that in many ways to me diminishes the IG report, because it's easy just to say this is a technical violation, this is a technical violation, this is a technical violation, but you have to understand that this really was an unprecedented historical moment. Now, that being said, you know, I've been in public life as a state, local, and federal prosecutor more than a decade. I've never once leaked anything.
Yeah, me
right.
Either.
And I can't say I've had the President of the United States fire me. You can.
but even in that context, I mean, totally different, not anywhere resembling what happened later to Jim Comey. But I felt that I had some story to tell about these phone conversations with the President. And you know what I did? And I'm not comparing myself favorably, I'm not patting myself on the back, but, and again, totally different context. But, you know, I guess I could have talked to the press and indirectly through someone told them, well, the President had been calling me and here's the series of events that led to my being asked to resign and why I didn't. I did an on-the-record interview with two reporters for the New York Times, and I fully laid out, here's what happened, here's when the President called me, here's what he said, here's what we talked about. Nothing classified in that whatsoever. But, you know, it's hard to second guess other people who are living through an extraordinary moment.
But there is a having been a prosecutor for a very long period of time and believing that leaks, they're deeply unfair and not the right way to proceed, in my view. And remember, there is one important distinction with the Comey piece, which is that there was an ongoing investigation. And so there was a connection to an ongoing investigation. When you were fired, it may have been connected, it may not have been, we don't know, but it really just sort of, there was nothing you were going to say or do that was going to be related at all to an existing investigation. Whereas with Comey, I think he could have done, if he couldn't have gone as far as you did, which is to just call up a reporter and have a direct conversation, or have the reporter call you and have the direct conversation, what he could have done is said, look, I believe that the President did things that were inappropriate, and I'd be happy to answer questions before Congress, and I've memorialized incidents that the Bureau has, and, you know, let the process sort of play out from there. So I think my point is there are a lot of ways he could have conveyed that message.
But in fairness, on his behalf, to argue from his perspective, and I tend to agree with you, but from his perspective, he's thinking, perhaps, well, if I make clear that I have this information, then someone will intercede, someone will get in the way, someone will prevent
it from
coming out.
Right, that's what he was afraid of. Right.
But I still go back to the issue. If you have important information, and you think there should be the appointment of a special counsel, and you're no longer in office, and you decide to get that information out indirectly with anonymity through a media outlet, that's sort of suggesting you were aware that it's inappropriate, because why not attach your name to
it? I agree. The anonymity piece and the leak, what makes it a leak is the anonymity piece, right? As opposed to him just coming out and saying, look, I know this is a violation. I know I shouldn't do it, but I'm a whistleblower and here's why I'm doing it. I wouldn't have agreed with that either, by the way. I think there are ways to have gotten it out, but it would have felt a little bit less sort of troublesome than the, you know, reaction, which is basically tell your friend to tell the New York Times that, hey, you know, Trump said inappropriate things and there are documents like that corroborate that.
But you know, I want to make clear again, people are listening to this, and I think people have strong views about this. I agree with the people and associate myself with the people who say that a comparison of the conduct by Jim Comey, as outlined in this report, compared to the conduct that he was setting forth and memorializing on the part of the president, is like not night and day, but like the deepest, darkest winter and summer. And various people who you and I know have tried to analogize this in various ways. I just want to read one of them. Because the context is important. And the IG, in an odd way, I don't think meant to do a disservice, but given the nature of the IG's job, I mean, the IG is not in the business of pronouncing judgment about what the president did, right? So the IG is pronouncing judgment on what Comey did and whether or not he abided by all the procedures and policies, and leaves out context, which I think for a public and for people in the public who like to weaponize reports, it leads to an unfortunate result. But here's my former colleague, Barbara McQuaid, the U.S. attorney in Detroit, who said, look, the report raises an important question about how we should treat whistleblowers. Criticizing Comey for mishandling documents that he felt conveyed an important threat to the public seems like scolding firefighters for getting your carpet wet while putting out a four-alarm blaze. What do you think about analogies like that?
So I think that Barbara McQuaid raised a really interesting and important point about whistleblowers that you and I are talking about, which is what do you do if you're the director of the FBI and you feel like you have to blow the whistle on someone? And I think this is a real conversation. It's a fair conversation. And I also agree that, look, part of the problem, and I think part of the problem that a lot of our colleagues are having, is that it looks like almost no rules apply to the president and that he's sort of above the law with his conduct in many different regards. I mean, take the most simple example is what you just talked about with him tweeting out what was a classified photo. And yes, he can declassify just like Jim Comey can declassify, you know, can classify, but it still does look like there are different standards for different people. But, and I really believe this very strongly, when other people act badly, right, it doesn't give you the right to act badly too. And so there are rules and values and principles that go beyond all of us. And it's a race to the bottom if we stop saying that everyone has to abide by the rules, even if we think that the president is not being held accountable.
What about Deep Throat? It just occurred to me. Right.
That's a great example.
He was the deputy director, Mark Felt.
Yeah.
Right. Their source for all this information.
And who was the deputy?
About the president of the United States, Richard Nixon, and who was the deputy director of the FBI. And history judges that a little bit differently.
Right.
And I don't know how we would have judged it then. I'm not saying this is that. But, you know, I think when we're making pronouncements about these kinds of things, that it's important to understand the wider context, what the motivations of the people were for engaging in the conduct. And it's a little bit easy to second guess. I don't think I would have done it that way. I don't think you would have done it that way. But look, you know, maybe if that hadn't been done, there wouldn't have been the appointment of a special counsel, which was the explicit goal stated by Jim Comey. And I think it was good that we had the appointment of a special counsel because, you know, whistleblowing is odd. Like, you know, whistleblowing you think of normally as being something where some bad conduct or waste or fraud or abuse is happening at some institution, governmental or otherwise, that nobody knows about. And so you whistleblow and usually you whistleblow to the FBI, right?
Right.
Or to the public, and then the FBI or the cops open up an investigation. Here, there already was an investigation, presumably, of some of these things, but it was just happening internally. And in an environment where Jim probably thought, well, I'm being fired. Maybe the next guy is going to get a loyalty oath like I got. You know, the next guy is going to be asked for loyalty.
Absolutely.
Like I got.
And maybe we'll give it.
Yeah. What kind of trust can I have
that
in the ordinary universe I would have that, you know, the regular order of things, the neutral and independent FBI, neutral and independent DOJ, will not have its will overborne by the president. I don't have faith and confidence in that anymore. The only way this is going to be able to get done is if there's a special counsel, which I actually agree with. I have some ability to move the needle on that by getting this information out. All I'm saying is, it is not crazy to be engaging in that thought process.
Right. I agree. I agree with that completely. And nor do I think it's clear. I actually do credit that Comey was completely authentic in saying, I was concerned about our democracy And I really did believe we needed a special counsel. And, you know, I was doing what I thought I needed to do. So I don't have any question of his sincerity. There's also a moment where I think that there were times when I was AG, and I'm sure you had them when you were U.S. attorney, where, you know, you're the person who has to decide and someone comes to you and you think, oh, yeah, who do you ask, right? Like, that's a crazy one. And the bottom line is the sort of buck stops with you. And, you know, he was the director of the FBI. There's no one else really he can turn to. You know, he had probably a variety of reasons to believe that there were issues at the senior level of the Department of Justice. So, like, it's not clear what avenues he had internally. I do believe, though, that I would have a slightly different view of this if we came to a point where it was clear that Comey had made a decision. The public needed to know that the president was interfering with the operation of the FBI and was asking the FBI director for a loyalty oath. If Comey had taken different steps to effectuate that, short of just like, boom, I'm going to leak it out under cloak of night through my buddy.
You just snapped your fingers.
I did.
That wasn't a sound effect.
It was a boom. It was like I was trying to do my like Emerald Boss. Bam.
You mean
I don't know? I'm conflating my
snaps her fingers. That's serious stuff. Because I don't think you've ever done that.
Do you know what I mean? Like, there's a way in which like he just decided like, yeah, the leak is the thing to do, and the goal of thinking that he had relevant information that was important for this conversation is different than the way he effectuated it.
Here's another observation to make, and again, I don't mean to compare my situation to Jim Comey's situation, but. You know, there's a lot of this rhetoric, heated rhetoric floating around about what were the motivations of Jim Comey. And you and I think, agree that he was worried about democracy. But some people might say, arguably, well, he was also angry because he had been shit-canned by the president. He had been fired by the president and fired in a pretty rude and obnoxious way. People will call
and embarrassed. He was out.
Yeah, he was in California and you know, he was out of a job.
He saw it on the news.
Not that Jim Comey needed the employment of the FBI. You know, to make a living. But there's lots of people who will say, well, if you were fired by the president, then maybe your motivation is revenge. And look, and I faced that a little bit. You know, I was fired by the president. Nothing I do, nothing I say, what I say on the podcast has anything to do with the fact that I was fired by the president, but not everyone's going to believe that.
Right.
People will say all the time on social media and otherwise and at events that I go to, well, you're saying all those things because you're a disgruntled fired employee. I'm saying those things because I'm also concerned about democracy. I think the most important thing for America is a defeat of Donald Trump in the next election. But, you know, people will be able to cast an aspersion on anyone who has some basis to have felt like they were wronged by the president.
The other complicating piece with Comey, for what it's worth, is that we've already seen an IG report about his conduct during the election. He went to the mic. I mean, there's another one to come, one or two more. Yes. And I strongly disagreed with him speaking publicly about ongoing investigations. And think it was one of the worst mistakes he made. And again, I like and respect him and think he had the best interests. I don't think he was thinking about his own personal gain at any moment in this. But that being said, it's also sort of, when you think about his critics, like it's set up for people to say, well, he just basically does what he thinks he needs to do and he puts himself above the rules. And so there is a sense of that sort of vibe, I think, going as well.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I do also agree with people who say that the report was pretty, I think, well-written, and the conclusions and the analysis is laid bare and is set forth pretty clearly and gives some ammunition to critics and gives some ammunition to Jim Comey. But I also think it's a little overwrought.
I feel the same.
Here's a sentence from the report. And, you know, people ask the question, what do you think about the IG? I know Michael Horowitz has been the IG for a number of years, served in the Obama administration, supposed to be independent, continued to serve under Trump. You know, I know him to be, you know, a good and honorable person also. Let me read this. By not safeguarding sensitive information obtained during the course of his FBI employment, and by using it to create public pressure for official action, Comey set a dangerous example for the over 35,000 current FBI employees and the many thousands more former FBI employees. What do you make of that? Dangerous?
Did you see that? I think it was Harry Littman who referred to Horowitz as a school hall monitor. And here's what I think is valid about it. The IG report sort of puts everything on the same level. And some of it, particularly Comey making the memos and keeping a copy, look, you can understand it. Your boss does something you think is terrible. You don't necessarily go and report your boss the first moment it happens. You write a memo to your file or an email. you keep a copy of that. Like, I think a lot of people could understand, like, it's a very human reaction to do it. And Horowitz equating all these things as sort of equally, you know, devastating violations of FBI policy and employment contracts just felt, it did feel overwrought to me. I do think that there's a line with the leak that is different. And I think he would have done a much better report if he basically acknowledged the context in which it was happening, acknowledged that there was no playbook, that Comey's intentions, again, I think were good, and then talked about, look, there are some violations that, you know, he violated, and these are technical letter of the law violations. But then there's one thing that's really a problem, which is taking into your own hands to leak information that he did know was related to an investigation. And so, you know, I think to me, it would have been a lot more credible, or I don't want to say it's not credible because I do think the report is credible, but the tone just was, it was over the top to me.
Yeah, I agree with that. But what's funny to me also, if anything about any of this can be funny, is the president's reaction. And it's totally predictable, right? When there's a report that's actually disastrous for him, like the Mueller report, he says, total exoneration. Total exoneration.
Exactly.
And there's a report here that's mixed for Jim Comey, as we said at the outset. You know, no lying, no leak of classified information, but, you know, strong terms violated policies and procedures. The president says, disastrous. and he says, quote, nowhere reflected in this IG report at all. Donald Trump tweeted, our rights and liberties were illegally stripped away by this dishonest fool.
Like, yeah, not true.
No,
yeah.
None of that was said. No. Now, I know Trump didn't read either one. And then there's this other model of principled conduct and behavior and modulated rhetoric. Jason Chaffetz, who used to be a member of Congress, who says, James Comey has been rebuked at the highest level with much more to come. An IG report doesn't get any stronger, calling him dangerous and insubordinate. Yeah, an IG report does get stronger.
Many of them have been. Yes, I agree. The other thing I have to just ask you is, why will Rod Rosenstein not stop talking about it? I mean,
I don't know what's going on with that Twitter account.
I don't know, but it's like he is also, you know, his tweet was, it is important to follow established policies and procedures, especially when the stakes are high. I mean, this is from the guy who it's been reported, again, I mean, I feel like you, that it was credible, that's been reported to have wanted to have wiretapped the president of the United States. And so it's like, some of the reaction, I think, is inaccurate. Some of it is unfair. What's fascinating to me is it's gotten a lot of people talking. You and I have just spent a lot of time talking about something that, other than the classified fact, like, we kind of knew all of it, right? I mean, there wasn't a lot new in it.
No, but it becomes weaponized in part because, you know, the president's allies want to attack Jim Comey because Jim Comey, you know, has posed something of a threat to the president. We know what the president feels about people who undermine him in any way, whether they work for him or whether they don't work for him.
Preet, we got a question about Andy McCabe from a listener named Ellen, who asks, Andrew McCabe potentially being criminally charged, what's behind it? Do they have a case? Can he defend with Trump tweets or the ins and outs of his relationship with DJT, Donald Trump? Inquiring minds want to know, how far can T, Trump, go to punish those who he thinks have betrayed him or who have been insufficiently loyal? Ellen.
So that brings us to the other issue of what's happening with Andrew McCabe, who is Jim Comey's deputy. And we've talked about this before on the show. There was another IG report some months ago, which made, actually, I think, worse findings than were made about Jim Comey. And that is lack of candor on the part of Andrew McCabe, which actually got him fired on the eve of vesting in a particular way with respect to his pension. And there's a lot of discussion about whether or not he's going to be charged. There has been reporting, and again, I don't know if they're true, that there have been meetings between Andy McCabe's lawyers and the U.S. attorney in the District of Columbia, who would be the decision maker on whether or not a charge would be brought, or at least one of the decision makers, and then also with the Deputy Attorney General.
Which is the number two person in the Department of Justice. And that's a high-level meeting.
Should we do the substance first or the tea leaves first?
Substance, maybe? Okay. Can we do it quick? I mean, the tea leaves are interesting.
So there are, let me just set it out, and I'm curious what you think. Yeah, you know, the Inspector General report lays out some facts on multiple occasions that it appears Andy McCabe was not fully candid. Those don't seem to be exaggerations. That's a much different thing than saying he should be criminally charged, because intent plays a huge role, the background and context play a huge role. To my mind, the thing that helps Andrew McCabe the most, and maybe other people have a different view, and I've seen some conflicting views on this, is that he made these statements about, you know, whether he authorized information to be given to the press. Again, another situation where a leak has gotten somebody in trouble with the press, that some days later, if I read the report correctly, he or his lawyers call the investigators back and say, you know, I've thought about it some more, McCabe has thought about it some more, and he wants to correct the record. I am not aware of cases in which somebody makes misleading statements that arguably are false, and then while the investigation is still pending, corrects them that a charge has been brought in those circumstances.
Right. I mean, yes. I mean, I have a couple of reactions. I mean, first, it does go back to leaking again. And I think now I feel like I might sound like a school monitor, but like leaking is bad and no good generally comes of it, in my view. And this is another example where McCabe authorized a leak to the Wall Street Journal that was doing an article about an investigation to the Clinton Foundation. And that was October of 2016, right before the election. And so McCabe gets questioned about it by the FBI in May of 2017 because it's a leak about a pending investigation. So they ask him questions. And he says at that time he did not approve it and didn't know who did. Other evidence is contrary to that. In late July, two investigators with the Inspector General's office interview McCabe about same exact question. And he says the same thing he said to the FBI, which is, I don't know, I didn't do it. And they audio record that. So that's on tape. Then a few days later, McCabe comes back and says, actually, no, that's not the case. And I, you know, misremembered. I did authorize someone to have this conversation with the Wall Street Journal. And the other piece of evidence, which I think sort of is been talked about a lot, is that one of the witnesses who's testified on this matter was Lisa Page, who, of course, has been in the news for having the text messages back and forth with Peter Strzok. And what she says is that McCabe authorized her to speak with the Wall Street Journal and that she didn't think he had a motive to lie because he was authorized as the deputy FBI director to share that information with the newspaper. So she's basically saying there's no motive because he could have done it or not done it. There's no real reason for him to lie. So I think, you know, a couple of things. One is the IG report is clear and I think compelling that McCabe was not truthful when he was with the FBI earlier in the summer. And then when the Inspector General interviewed him later, he was also not truthful. And that's going back to May of 2017. And then the late July interview with the Inspector General. So I think he did correct it, but, you know, he had a set of statements going back to May that were also not truthful that he hadn't corrected. So that's one point. But the bigger point to me, and the thing that concerns me greatly about this, is that if you and I were to think about, if we were to think about who gets charged with false statements, it's generally people who are who are part of a criminal investigation, where there's an active investigation into whether or not a crime was committed, and that it's not an internal disciplinary question. And the fact that somebody lies really thwarts that investigation. So we actually can never know whether or not a crime was committed. Here, McCabe is being interviewed because of a violation of, like, it's not a criminal investigation that McCabe is undergoing. It's part of his sort of employment. And it's very, very rare that we charge people who lie when they're being interviewed by their employer.
But the other thing is, we keep falling into this. I'm not going to say it's a trap, but I like to think we're careful lawyers and we think about precedent. We say, well, look, in an ordinary situation, someone, this position might not be charged for these reasons, et cetera, et cetera. But that's not the situation here. You have all that going on. And at the same time, you have a president of the United States with the largest bully pulpit on the earth who is clamoring for retaliation against, by name, Andy McCabe,
right,
over and over and over and over again. And so maybe in a different context, conceivably, a federal criminal charge against Andrew McCabe would be warranted. I'm not saying it is, but perhaps it might be.
I think that would be out of the norm, though. Even that
would be
deeply out of the norm.
But now in the context of everyone having a loss of faith in how decision-making in the Department of Justice is done and whether decisions are made based on whether or not you're an ally of the president or a critic of the president, to now charge criminally Andrew McCabe is going to give no one confidence that decision was being made for the right reason. So the president himself, by the way, has caused situations time and time again where even, you know, objectively neutral, arguably correct, hypothetically correct decision-making is called into question.
Right. I agree with you on that. Let's go to the present piece in one second. But I would just argue objectively on the facts here, I would not charge this case. And I would not charge it because of the fact that it was an internal employment matter and that he did ultimately correct the record. That I think he, and again, we're outside, so I'm not looking at completely the inside, but I do not think there could be circumstances that you and I don't know sitting on the outside. But given what we know in the IG report and given the sort of internal sort of employment matter focus of this inquiry, I am comfortable saying that he's been held accountable for his actions. He was fired. If anything, it was an extreme version of it to do the pension thing.
Do you think it was appropriate for there to be a criminal investigation?
I think it's always the case, yes. I mean, the short answer is yes. And the reason why is that it's almost always the case that inspector general reports are referred to the U.S. Attorney's Office for review. And that's because there are potential violations of the law. And so if that's the process and the standard, yes, I think it's fair that they did with Comey, with McCabe, what they always do. Now, do I think there are real issues? Like, let's talk about this specific case beyond what you just said about the president. And I agree with you. You can't take Trump out of the, you can't take him out of this equation that you have the essentially leader of the United States of America calling for somebody to be charged and prosecuted, right? Which is deeply problematic. Right. You also have, and this is tea leaves, but you also have two prosecutors stepping down from the case.
Yeah, but I don't know what I understand. I don't know if I believe that to be about decision-making, differences of opinion or not. Like, that's always iffy to me.
I don't know. One, I wouldn't really blink at. Two, I find unusual, right? And so, and again, we are reading tea leaves a little, but I do find two unusual. I also find, you know, one of them went to private practice.
Right.
Law firms can wait for you for 6 months or a year if you have high-profile matter, for example, that you were prosecuting. So there's a little bit here that does feel strange to me. And again, I don't want to draw conclusions, but there's a certain, I think that there are fair questions to be asked about the impartiality of the Department of Justice and whether or not the president has influenced this matter.
There needs to be public confidence in decision-making at law enforcement. And whether you like it or not, sometimes those things can be influenced by the general context. Now, to be clear, just because the president has said shit about you should not grant you immunity from prosecution.
Yes, agreed. Right?
You know, in different contexts, people have said and things that have been harmful to prosecutions. You every once in a while get an over-aggressive president or attorney general talking about some scourge, a mafia member, or someone else. You know, something was said about Khalid Sheikh Mohammed by the attorney general once, which was not helpful to a future fair jury pool potentially. So it doesn't mean you're off the hook if you've done something bad. In the same way, you shouldn't be off the hook if one agent, you know, misbehaved in a particular way. If you did the crime, you did the crime.
Yep.
But depending on what the crime is, what the nature of it is, and how much pressure there has been brought to bear on bringing a criminal case against an adversary, I think you take that into account also.
Don't you feel like, maybe that's not the right way to ask this, but here's something that concerns me is that there's a lot of negative about the FBI, right? In this sort of news cycle of Jim Comey, Andy McCabe leaking, questions of whether or not there were violations of the law, questions of whether or not classified information was leaked. Even that conversation, to frame this conversation this way, I think is deeply cuts at the view of the institutions, right? And I think, you know, the president has an interest, I think, in undercutting institutions often and basically saying, you know, you can't trust anyone, including the FBI. And I worry a lot about, you and I are having a pretty, you know, sincere legal conversation about, you know, who should be charged, who shouldn't be charged, what's the right and fair thing. And at the end of the day, the president is in some ways succeeding in framing the FBI and its leaders as partisan and untruthful or people who engage in conduct that is in violation of even just their employment rules. That's a problem for us as a country. And I think, you know, again, I want the inspector general to have, you know, he has to do or she has to do what they have to do. And it's really important that people be held accountable. But there is something about this larger conversation that I think, you know, it is deeply problematic in terms of our institutions. And look, I believe very much that the men and women in the FBI, you know, overwhelmingly are extraordinary Americans, people who do their best for the country. So I think it's not a fair perception of them, but I do think that there's some framing going on here that is, you know, deeply troubling to me. Where are you having your Christmas party? In other news.
Yeah, you know, mine probably cost a little less than $30,000.
Yeah. So, Preet, We got a question from Twitter from at E. Snyder, Eric Snyder. At Preparar, love the pods. AG Barr has booked a $30,000 family party at the DC Trump Hotel. Is this a violation of the Emoluments Clause or just gross impropriety? If not illegal, why not? Hashtag ask Preet.
Sitting Attorney General Bill Barr has been in the news lately because apparently he has decided to have a personal family holiday party / Christmas party. I say Christmas when appropriate, at the Trump Hotel.
Yes.
In DC, which is near the Department of Justice. Now, right off the bat, let me say a couple of things.
Yeah.
It is not unlawful. No one is saying it is unlawful. It is not even an ethical violation. And people who are as well-versed as Walter Schaub, who's a former head of the Office of Special Counsel at the White House, has, I think, opined that it doesn't clearly violate an ethical rule. George Conway, the husband of Kellyanne Conway.
A fervent critic of the president.
Very, very, very fervent critic of the president. He reacted dismissively and said, frankly, this is on Twitter, quote, frankly, this is a silly story. Barr is paying for the party out of his own pocket. The hotel is next door to DOJ. Separate from that, if you believe the reporting, he apparently tried to hold his party at some other hotels and he had a contract with one, I think the Willard, maybe I have that wrong, he had a signed contract with the Willard Hotel, which is very nice.
Who was either double booked or they realized that they didn't want to host Bill Barr and his quote friends.
We are double booked.
It's funny. We didn't check our calendar before we took your
$10,000. Sorry, Mr. Barr. Double booked. Nice hotel.
That seems a little weird to me. Like the Willard is like a serious organization, right?
Who are you bumping the AG for?
Yeah.
Do you know that?
It'd be great if it was Trump.
Yeah, I believe he's a cabinet official.
He is.
I would think the Willard would have handled the double booking.
I also don't believe that the Willard would have double booked. I mean, it's possible anyone could have done it, but...
Look, all our institutions are crumbling.
It's like one by one, even the Washington, D.C. hotels.
The booking systems at elite Washington hotels are not what they used to be in the age of Trump, my friend.
I mean, okay, it's illegal, but I mean, what a bad look, right? What a bad idea.
He clearly doesn't care.
He doesn't care.
You know that you bought all this criticism. You may think it's stupid, and you have to have this party, and you know that people are going to go bananas over it. I think some people have gone more bananas than they should. I think I'm clear-eyed about this.
I think it looks terrible.
Not in a million years, if I were in that position, in fairness again to him, they say they consulted with ethics officials who said, like other people have said, like critics of the president have said, doesn't clearly violate an ethical rule. But there's lots of stuff you do that doesn't violate an ethical rule. There's lots of stuff you can do that doesn't violate an ethical rule. And depending on the circumstances, you don't do it. And why you would engage in this silly party thing when there's already a lot of people who doubt the fairness of your decision-making and the neutrality of your position and whether or not you're trying to curry favor with the president. I mean, do I think that there's going to be a huge difference in the relationship between the attorney general and the president based on this booking? No. But also, what else has happened in the last week? Last week, as we sit here and record this, the vice president of the United States is in Ireland. And he's staying, I think, 3 hours away from Dublin, where he's going to have official meetings. You know why? Because the president suggested to him, why don't you stay at my property and then your taxpayer money and my taxpayer money is being spent on sending Mike Pence 3 hours to take a helicopter and all the safety issues that causes. And then on top of that, the president of the United States himself goes on television in an extended advertisement for one of his own other freaking properties in Florida, says, we're going to host the G7. At my property in Florida, because it's wonderful and it's near the airport. In the context of that, the G7, the vice president, for Bill Barr to say like, hey, nothing to see here. I'm having my private Christmas party for $30,000 at the president's hotel. It just is gross.
It's corrupt. No, totally. And whether it's an official ethics violation or not, he shouldn't have done it.
I didn't mean to get heated.
Yeah, I'm heated too. Who throws a $30,000 Christmas party? Number one. Number two, you and I both went to a lot of DOJ functions. They were generally at the bar down the street and everybody paid their way. A lot of times they were at people's houses who hosted or it was a potluck.
Yeah, so look, I don't begrudge someone having having an expensive party if you can afford it. But in light of all this other nonsense, and by the way, I do think also, like, no cabinet official should do it. The Labor Secretary shouldn't do it, the Treasury Secretary. But I think above all people, the Attorney General shouldn't do it. It just is silly. Even if the criticism is silly, if I'm sitting in the office, I'm thinking, well, you know, there's nothing wrong with this. doesn't violate anything. People are making a mountain out of a molehill. Even George Conway thinks it's okay.
He still wouldn't do it. Like,
why?
And by the way, you
why
would
do
have
you need
people
to
surrounded.
Buy criticism? Exactly. Why do you need to buy it? You don't need to buy, what's the thing you told me, you know, your aunt or your mother?
That saying, like, you know, I can afford trouble, but I don't want to buy it. And that this is a great example of, actually, I don't think Bill Barr can afford trouble because he's undercutting the institution of the Department of Justice, because there are a lot of people who question his fairness after the Mueller report and his non-summary. And so to come out and look like he's beholden and basically lining the pocket of the president of the United States, it's a bad look. There's no reason for him to be doing it.
I'll tell you a quick story.
Also, by the way, if you and I called around to other hotels and restaurants in D.C.,
we should ask.
I bet we could find a place for him to host the party.
People.
Yes.
Very quick story. It's a totally different circumstance. But when I was the U.S. attorney, we had a meeting to discuss the upcoming conference. Every I think, 2 years or so, or, you know, with some regularity, we would have a U.S. attorney conference. And all the U.S. attorneys in the country, they meet and they have educational programs and the attorney general talks. And, you know, you share notes about how to run your offices. And I forgot where we were doing it. We were doing it somewhere outside of Washington, D.C., and there were two hotels. And one was named whatever it was called. I don't know, the Hilton something. And the other was called the Ritz. It turns out that the Ritz was the exact same price as the other hotel. And for various reasons, logistical or otherwise, I don't remember, the Ritz was the preferable hotel for us. We, I think, voted unanimously not to have it at the Ritz.
Right, because it looks bad.
It looks bad.
Yeah, and I'll tell you something else. The AG events, right, every year there's a number of annual AG meetings, and there are a number of AGs who are elected, and so there are events that are hosted by people who are contributors to the AGs, often big business, and they host these events for the Democratic and the Republican AGs and all the AGs together, and I never attended a single one. Because I felt compromised that if I would go and I potentially would sue one of these companies, and there were companies that were ultimately sued in the history of time that had hosted things at AG events, like I just didn't want to be involved in anything that the appearance would have undercut. People would have been justified in asking, was I making decisions based on the facts and the substance versus relationships or other things? And you just don't want to put yourself in that position. So the final takeaway is I would not host a party at Donald Trump's hotel.
You want to end on a tweet? Are you going to read a tweet for us, Anne?
Yes. Yes.
Is it from the president of these United States?
It is from the president of the United States. And you had sent it to me the other day. And
part of my week is spent thinking, could Anne read
funny?
This with a straight
what's
face
funny?
Or not?
Well, it's often a tragicomedy. I don't know whether to laugh
three
or cry.
Parts. Yeah.
Trump tweet, August 31. Has anyone noticed that the top shows on Fox News and cable ratings are those that are capital F fair parentheses or great to your favorite president? Me.
Exclamation mark.
Exclamation point. Congratulations to Sean Hannity for being the number one shoe on cable television.
I always thought Hannity was like the number two shoe.
What kind of a shoe would he be? Sneaker, sandal?
I think he would be
stiletto.
Not a stiletto.
Cowboy boot. Loafers. Yeah. The dad sandal look with socks.
Say that again.
Preach has looked at me so there was just a look of pure fear in your eyes. You're like,
no, you know why?
I'm a dad. I don't wear socks with my sandals.
Because I don't want to be thinking about Sean Hannity's feet. And you're making me do that.
Well, Donald Trump made you do that. Don't blame the conduit. I'm just the vessel for the image. You know what's extraordinary about this? Both that we're talking about Sean Hannity's shoes and that the president of the United States fires off these tweets so quickly with so little care that he can't even bother to spell show right.
Right. Sometimes it's, you know, classified photograph taken by one of our satellites. And sometimes, look, the number one shoe.
Can we go to the classified photos for 1 second? There are a couple of scientists who have like literally pinpointed what satellite took the... I don't know if you followed this on Twitter, but it's amazing. You can watch like a 30-part thread where they pinpointed what satellite, where, how far it was, and have been able to calculate an incredible amount of detail from that one photograph, which is an example of why it shouldn't have been posted. What are you going to post this week, Preet?
I don't know. I don't plan these in advance.
Pictures of your shoes.
Pictures of my shoes. All right. So I'll see you next weekend. We'll be back next Monday at our usual hour and day. So send us your questions to insider@cafe.com.
And we'll do our best to answer them.
One more quick note, the Cafe Insider newsletter will be sent on Thursday this week instead of Wednesday. This is the Cafe Insider podcast. Your hosts are Preet Bharara and Ann Milgram. The executive producer is Tamara Sepper. The senior producer is Aaron Dalton. And the Cafe team is Carla Pierini, Julia Doyle, Calvin Lord, Vinay Basti, and Jeff Eisenman. Our music is by Andrew Dost. Thank you for being a part of the Cafe Insider community. This fall, Stay Tuned is going back on the road. Denver, Atlanta, Minneapolis, and Detroit. Head to cafe.com/tour now for tickets. Hope to see you there.